south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, now here's something completely new and different. It was of great interest to me. I don't know if it's of interest to you, but it's certainly a topic that needs to be discussed sooner or later. So let me read this from Eddie, not expat Eddie. This one's Eddie in Philadelphia. He says, Johnny, I plan on moving to Latin America within a year. Like you, I'm also an engineer, a mechanical engineer. I heard you talking on your show a couple of months ago about electric cars in Latin America and how there were very, very few of them. But that's, I guess, to be expected, considering, as you say, there's lag time for everything coming from the first world down to Latin America and any place in the third world. My first question is, Johnny, how many of your listeners who seem to be very smart and probably in the upper tax brackets too, how many of them actually have electric cars? It would be interesting to find out. I can tell you this, Norway has the most electric cars per capita with just a little over 50%. That's because they offer all kinds of tax incentives and gasoline, something like 8 to 10 bucks a gallon, with 80% of the gasoline costs being government taxes. And as far as the U.S. and California, about 45% of all the new car sales are electric, again, because of tax incentives and the high cost of gas. Makes you wonder what's going to happen to the electric car market when the tax incentives go away. Especially with this COVID thing, all governments, including state governments, are completely bankrupt. It's a 100% sure thing that they're all going to increase taxes, not lower them. That we can all count on, so buckle up. Here's the thing, Johnny. When I bought my first Nissan Leaf in 2017, it was used. I paid $15,000 for it, and I was very nervous. Even as an engineer, I was nervous. Back then, in 2017, a Nissan Leaf only had 100-mile range, while most of the newer ones had 2, even 300-mile range, but they cost 30 grand or more. All the while, I was thinking, and my wife was pestering me about this too, something with only 100-mile range, would that be enough? Would I regret that decision and my car end up in the garage as an expensive toy? Turned out, and I never really calculated this before, but the vast majority of my driving is in town in less than 10 miles at a clip. So I can put 10 to 70 miles a day on it and plug it into my 220-volt dryer outlet in my garage every time it's home, and I always have a full battery every morning. And Johnny, I did the calculations too. With equivalent $2 a gallon gas, my electric cost that would get me the same range as a gallon of gas, about 30 miles, would be around 60 cents as opposed to having a regular internal combustion car engine. And since I got the car, I installed solar panels on my roof. And the battery pack in my Nissan Leaf is 30 kilowatts. So I installed 20 300-watt panels. That's 6 kilowatts charging into my car battery every hour when there's decent sun. That'll just about charge my battery up completely in 5 or 6 hours. The solar panels without batteries set me back around $4,000. People ask me all the time, solar panels with no batteries? I say, I do have a battery, duh, the car battery. So if you just use the panels to charge your car, you don't have to buy batteries at all. That would be nuts. And now it costs me nothing to drive at all, except the occasional replacement of windshield wipers and tires. And you know what, Johnny? It's so much more fun to drive an electric car than a gas guzzler. You can't believe it. It's crazy. But here's the confusing part. While this all works for me, it doesn't work for my wife, at least not in her mind. I'm with her on the idea to have a backup vehicle, though I suppose we could just rent a car for the rare longer trips that are over 100 miles. Meanwhile, I've got a big old tank of an SUV sitting in the garage that's worth 20 grand or so, and it almost never gets used, except for trips back and forth to Menards and the hardware store to feed my weekend do-it-yourself project fix. But you know, Johnny, there's one thing you never hear about, and I never heard about it either. Electric cars are heavier than most cars and trucks due to those big batteries, so the damage to the roads as they continuously amble on means there's a lot more wear and tear on the roads than with a regular car. If everyone goes electric, how are we going to collect road taxes? Because gasoline and diesel currently pay the road bills. At least that's what our government tells us, that the tax on your gas is supposed to pay for road maintenance and bridge and highway construction. Though I've suspected for a long time that could be a lie. They just dump that money into the general treasury and whatever programs short, well, they borrow from Peter to pay Paul, just like Social Security. If anyone really thinks that fund exists, they're living in la-la land. By the way, Johnny, did you know that Teslas are too heavy to legally cross the Brooklyn Bridge? They exceed the weight limits for vehicles with four wheels. That's a small fact that you never see reported. In fact, if you drive along country roads out in the boonies, you'll go over many small bridges that all have a weight limit posted, and Teslas are mostly over the limit. So maybe fining electric car drivers will pay the road taxes. It's all about the weight of the batteries, of course, but then again, that's what makes electric cars so maneuverable on curves and at high speeds. You should see my Nissan Leaf take curves, though I never lead-footed it with the wife in the car. She tends to freak out. But man, when you've got that kind of power and acceleration, boys will be boys, even when the boy's a geezer. Oh, and Johnny, when you talk about those massive speed bumps in Latin America, the first thing that came to mind was that the batteries are the lowest point in an electric car, and they're also the most expensive part of an electric car. I keep thinking, one good smack against one of those speed bumps and you're in for an ultra-expensive repair bill. One more thing people don't realize when they see, for example, the Tesla factory and all that automation and extreme technology that goes into those cars, people think electric cars are rather delicate. They're not. Electric cars are much easier to build, in fact, and it takes half as many people to produce a car. In other words, the workforce is cut by 50% in an electric car factory. They have less than half the moving parts of an internal combustion engine car. And it's always the moving parts that wear down in any car. They're the weak links in any mechanical object because they touch and mesh with each other. In engineering, friction and heat kill. Things like gears, bearings, spindles, rotors, and hinges, etc., those are the things that eventually wear down and need to be replaced. People have heard of overhauling a car. Rings, pistons, valves, valve stems, main bearings, fuel filters, pumps, and injectors. Well, electric cars have none of those parts in them, so they never need an overhaul. And there's another thing that bugs me, Johnny. Every so often, you see in the news, and it's mostly a Tesla because they're all in vogue now, you'll see one that's crashed and burned in a real fiery display. So it looks and sounds to the public that electric cars are very dangerous, especially in big accidents. Think about this. How dangerous would it be for passengers trapped in an electric car when it's been involved in a major accident? Answer, not much at all. Not compared to an equivalent accident in a gas-powered car. Think of gas leaking and igniting. How many times have you seen that scene in a Hollywood movie? Drip, drip, drip. You see the gas puddle as the firemen with the jaws of life race against the clock. That could never happen with an electric car, so I guess Hollywood's going to have to think of another way to make us squirm in our seats. Because a conventional car leaking gas and igniting is 100 times more likely to hurt or kill a passenger than any battery or electrical problem in an EV. So, Johnny, I started out this little rant talking about the conundrum I had, worrying about the maximum distance I'd be able to drive in a Nissan Leaf. That 100-mile limit on a charge was a real problem for me. But now, in late 2020, the newer SUVs have tripled that range and more. With Tesla in a class by itself, with a 400-mile-per-charge range. Johnny, if you or your listeners are ever stuck in that other big argument about electric cars, I'm sure you've heard it before, that it takes hours to charge them up, and with your gas car, only 5 minutes to fill the tank. Well, they're certainly working on it, and it's pretty much been conquered. In a Tesla, if your battery's running low, you can do a quick charge in 30 minutes and drive another 4 hours. No other electrics have that capability yet, but they all will by mid-2021. Though, it must be said that rapid charging does lower the life of the batteries, but I can't see many people doing that at all. Seems to me you'd only want to do a rapid charge in an emergency, not when you can leave your car charging overnight and have a range of 400 plus miles in the morning when you jump in. That's equivalent to a full tank of gas in any regular car. One last thing, Johnny. When you're at a dinner party or a get-together and people find out you're driving an electric car, you get all kinds of questions and people want to go out and look at it. In a way, it makes you feel like the rich kid in high school who had the coolest car. Especially if you've got a Tesla. If you're a nerd, it kind of makes you instantly popular. I know it's just a temporary phenomenon. It won't last long. The more electric cars come online, the less attention they'll receive. And how about this, Johnny? All the car questions I get. come from men exclusively. So you could say electric cars kind of provoke sexism, just like back in the muscle car days. I also find the most common misunderstanding among non-electric owners is that an electric vehicle uses about the same amount of energy to get from point A to point B. This is not factual because gasoline engines must be kept running all the time. That means when they're going downhill, coasting to a stop, or just idling at a traffic light, or just inching along in stop-and-go traffic. Well, John, since I am a mechanical engineer, I couldn't help but do the numbers. I estimate with my 2017 Nissan Leaf, with its ancient EV technology, I can go about 120 miles on the energy that would be in a gallon of gas. Simply because when you're in an electric car and going downhill, idling, or coasting to a stop, you're using no energy from the batteries at all. And if you put your hand on a regular gas car engine, you'll probably burn it because they always run hot. And that heat is wasted. That's pure inefficiency. Gas engines have always been huge, continuous wasters of energy. Thank God we're now over that hump. That brings me to my final question. I will be moving to Latin America. I've been there a few times. I had my boots on the ground. And I've never seen an electric car, though I've seen a few hybrids and Priuses. What I have noticed is that many older cars that you would never see on the road up in the States end up in Latin America. There's a constant flow of used and wrecked cars coming down from the auto auctions up in Texas, ending up in Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras, Nicaragua, and points out. I noticed while driving around in rental cars and Ubers, it was like every time I was stuck behind someone, I'd always notice the dealer logo sticker where it was bought. In almost every case, unless it was a very new car, it was some Jeep, Dodge, Honda, Nissan, or Ford dealership from somewhere up in the U.S. That means almost every used car I was driving behind was first purchased at a dealer up in the States and somehow made it down to Latin America. I suspect, Johnny, and it's probably not a good thing, it'll be the same with older EVs that have been discarded up in the States. That means the older ones, the wrecks, the EVs with their batteries on their last legs are going to end up in Latin America. So, Johnny, I'd like to hear your take on that. Thanks for the great shows. Signed, Stanford. Well, Stan, a lot of good information there. Thanks for that. And I totally agree with you. I believe lots of used and somewhat iffy electric cars are going to end up here in Latin America quite soon. But again, as you say, they're so much more dependable than regular gasoline cars and so fewer moving parts. I believe it's all going to boil down to a battery problem again. The question will be, how can you tell how much life is left in that battery once it ends up down here? Because, as Stanford mentioned, the batteries in an EV are the most expensive part of the car. In fact, just now I checked a few battery supply houses up in the States, and a new battery for a 2017 Nissan Leaf is around $6,000. And that's the stateside cost. Then you have to add import taxes and shipping, and those things weigh a ton. So you're probably looking at $7,000 or even $7,500. Though in a couple of years, when those hundreds of thousands of electric cars up in the States start showing their age, that means there'll be hundreds of thousands of used battery packs on the market, all of them with a somewhat limited life. And we'll just have to see how that shakes out. For now, it's too early to tell. Plus, you can count on some big battery breakthroughs in the next couple of years, too. And maybe, just maybe, it's a good thing that electric cars have not made it down here in any kind of big way yet. The question is, when they do start showing up on the car lots, would you buy one? I think no matter what the projected savings, most Latinos will be too gun-shy to pull a trigger. It's going to be a difficult learning curve, that's for sure. But as for me, I guarantee, just as soon as one of the usual suspect electric car companies comes out with a standard-sized pickup or a small or mini SUV, something with a lot of ground clearance, I will buy one. I'm a solar guy with a driving urge to get off the grid permanently. And part of that involves never having to buy a gallon of gasoline again. But that's just me. Though in a way, it's good for you. That means if you keep listening to future episodes of the show, you can follow along with my victories and setbacks as I move along on that trajectory. So pay attention. Solar power and electric cars are the future. You don't want to be left behind. Meanwhile, one of the top articles today on internet and the rest of the media highlights the fact that American tourists face bans and restrictions across the world due to their indecisive pandemic response. What they're saying is a U.S. passport ain't the grade-A document it used to be. Speaking of making it more and more difficult to get the hell out of Dodge, this article starts by saying The reputation and prestige once associated with a passport from the United States has suffered drastically as a result of the coronavirus response. For Americans right now, it says, traveling is harder than ever. They're not welcome in the majority of the world's countries because the U.S. response to the outbreak has fluctuated so. As a result, it says, the U.S. passport ranking has fallen 50% in the last year, down from the number 3 spot for ease of travel to the number 19 spot, according to the International Passport Ease of Travel Index. Which brings us right back to the fact that more and more thinking people, people with a brain, are getting the hell out of Dodge or making plans to do so. My ultimate plan B choice, as always, is Latin America. Not everywhere in Latin America, of course. There are some places you don't want to be and places that are absolute paradise. The key, again, is to get boots on the ground. I mean, really, you can go on the internet all day and night. Load yourself up with reams of facts and figures. See 1,000 YouTubes. Nothing wrong with that, of course. At least it'll get you pointed in the right direction and help narrow your choices down to a few destinations. But there's just no substitute for boots on the ground. Then again, there's quality grade A boots on the ground and the kind of boots on the ground where you're just spinning your wheels. I mean, look, you could book a nice all-inclusive vacation to Cancun or Playa del Carmen or whatever. Go back home and tell all your friends you got boots on the ground, and you did. And though that vacation might have been a lot of fun, though, as far as its contribution to your Plan B research, it's worth almost nothing. However, if you want a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, there's no better way to do it and no better way to get boots on the ground than to come down to my January 2021 Expat Insider Seminar. Read all about it, the prices, the itinerary, everything at expatplanb.com. And remember, we've got a 3-payment plan. And, of course, people have been asking, what happens if there's another round of COVID and they lock down the airports once again as you get closer to the seminar? Well, everyone gets their money back, every dime of it. You know, for the August seminar that was supposed to launch right about now, that we had to cancel because of the lockdowns, everyone who signed up got their money back. Though a few people elected to let their deposits ride until the 2021 seminar. But everyone who wanted a refund got it within a couple of days. So don't worry about losing a dime, you won't. In fact, since most everyone pays through PayPal, you know, I really can't stand PayPal myself, but they have one good policy that's in your favor. They allow you to get a full refund within 180 days. That's a half a year. So if you buy anything with PayPal and you're unhappy with anything you bought or there's a cancellation, whatever, you can get a full refund up to a half a year after you made the purchase. It's a good thing to know. All right, now a question from another listener, Mr. C. Johnny, hope you're doing well and living your best life. Here in Austin, Texas, COVID is blowing up, and we've already had more than 10 100-plus degree days, and my kid can't go back to school. And some dumbass carrying a rifle at a BLM protest last night just got shot by another protester. And unfortunately, I haven't been to my house on Lake Atitlan since Thanksgiving. Oh, man, and that hurts. So, Johnny, what about homeowners insurance in Latin America? I spoke to my Latino lawyer about it, and he referred me to some broker who can offer it, though he said it's just not typical. I think this would be a helpful discussion on your show, and your insight would be appreciated. Well, Mr. C, good question. You know, insurance here in Latin America is a very new thing. In fact, when I got down here 30 years ago, they were just starting with car insurance. And though most Latin countries now have mandatory car insurance, I'd say up to 80% of the drivers on the road don't even have that. And you'd think if the cops pulled you over, they'd ask you for that insurance card just to make sure you're keeping up with the law. But they don't. And I'll tell you right now, I haven't met a single motorcycle driver who's ever had insurance. And 50% of those don't even have a valid driver's license. You've heard me say that before. Funny enough, though, the thing that put insurance of any kind on the radar screen was the transnational companies that came in, like Costco, McDonald's, Taco Bell, Kentucky Fried, the first world franchises who always give some kind of insurance plan to their workers up in the States. And because franchises are intended to be exact copies of each other all over the world, wherever they might be, that means a McDonald's and a Costco here in Latin America will, just like in the States, offer health insurance to their employees. And now, since Latin America is just loaded with first world franchises and companies, private health insurance and insurance brokers in general can be found in any city. But what about homeowners insurance or umbrella coverage? Well, still, because insurance is a new industry, people here in Latin America don't view it quite like first world Americans do. For example, I was told by an insurance broker in my own family up in the States that it's well known in the insurance business, the first bill an American pays is his rent. Second bill, his car loan, if he's got one. Number 3, his monthly insurance payment.
That's kind of burned into the psyche of every American, besides playing the lotto. But the fact is, 99% of Latin Americans don't have homeowners insurance, nor umbrella insurance for their businesses. And it's not just because insurance is a new thing. It's mostly because Latinos don't sue each other. It's not a litigious society. And the fact is, if you fell down in a hospital or a Costco parking lot and you tried to sue, your lawyer won't take it seriously. He just might laugh at you. Then again, you can buy a policy. They exist, but almost no one ever does buy one. I never have, and I don't know a single gringo or expat who has, though all fresh green gringos ask about it at first. And some do get sucked in, though if they're down here long enough, they figure out eventually it's money in the toilet. Oh, and remember, up in the States, it's all about deductibles, right? Same thing here. So then you might ask, what about thieves and robbery? Well, fact is, almost all the thieving done down here is very small potatoes. When I've had people steal things from me at my house, and usually it's workers or cleaning ladies, whatever, it's been a bike, a spare tire, a fishing rod, a radio, nothing that could make the purchase of a theft policy worthwhile once you consider the deductible, which usually starts at $500. And since your major crime here in Latin America is petty theft, it makes no sense to report it. And since the major coverage you have with an umbrella policy, fire, theft, earthquake, water damage, well, I can tell you one thing, your house is never going to burn. Houses down here are made of concrete and rebar. Oh, they've got wooden doors and wooden trim in the nicer houses too, but nothing that's really going to catch fire. And of course, they've got fire departments everywhere called bomberos. But nearly all of their calls are into poor neighborhoods where many people don't have concrete houses, and they do build with 2x4s and plywood. But neighborhoods that are middle class and higher are always concrete, rebar, and glass. And about flooding, of course, you've got a heavy rainy season. But the only people who ever get flooded out are the ones that built way too close to a river or a lake, people who didn't do proper planning when they first built or bought their places. You'd be surprised how many people don't respect or even know about the 50 or 100-year floodplains. And as far as earthquakes, I've been through them. In fact, two whoppers, a 6 and 7-pointer. But as always, if your house is built to anti-seismic code, it'll shake a bit, but you won't have any real damage. In fact, I can think of none of my gringo friends and acquaintances, or my Latin friends and acquaintances, who've ever had any real earthquake damage, even in those two whoppers. That's not to say it won't happen, but remember, when you live down here in Latin America, labor is unbelievably cheap. For example, you could get a carpenter or a mason or a jack-of-all-trades for something like $20 to $25 a day. That means, let's say, a hurricane comes through and you lose half your roof. It won't cost you thousands, only hundreds. By the way, that has happened to me. And the damages in that case? Something like $800. And you know, if I would have had an insurance policy that protected me against hurricanes, and you can get them, I probably couldn't have collected because it didn't reach the deductible. By the way, I have a gringo friend in Costa Rica who's got a hurricane policy, and his deductible is $2,000. So in my case, even with the loss of a half a roof, it wouldn't have done me any good anyway. Bottom line, should you get insurance? Well, again, it's your call, and I know gringos don't feel comfortable unless they're all policied up. And you know, the first few years I was down here, I felt the same way too. And I've had some pretty nice cars and properties over the years that were not insured. Well, I take that back. My cars were always insured, but I never had full coverage. I just had liability, even with the newer cars. Because I knew whatever might happen, I could always get things repaired for a song. Again, it's your call, but all I personally carry is basic liability car insurance, no matter what car I have. And that sets me back around $150 a year. And, of course, I have a nice private health insurance policy, too. The one I have right now has no deductible, and I pay less than $100 a month. However, I do know that fresh green gringos are all nervous about getting homeowners insurance right away. And I say, it's money in the crapper. And for gringos and expats who say, look, Johnny, with the lag time thing, eventually Latinos are going to start suing people, like up in the States. Well, that's one lag time prediction I disagree with, because the lawyer contingency payment system you have up in the States is not permitted here in Latin America. That's what drives so many frivolous lawsuits up by you. Down here, you have to pay the lawyer up front and as the case rolls along. No contingency. That's the single biggest reason why Latinos rarely sue each other. And it's the single biggest reason why Latinos don't have homeowners or umbrella coverage. Because you have to have money up front to pay a lawyer to sue someone. All right, Mr. C asks another question in his email. It's about the internet. He says, in the little village above Lake Atitlan where my house is, I've been told that a local company could hook me up with internet and Wi-Fi. I don't doubt it. I just wonder if that's my best option.
ultimately, I want reliability, but I wouldn't want to pay an excessive amount for it. You talk about living off the tourist trail and out in the boonies. I think a discussion on the best way to get internet access would be appreciated. All right, Mr. C, let's have that discussion. Here's the thing. If you live out in the boonies or in some remote spots around Lake Atitlan, you might have spotty internet. I'm talking about the usual suspect internet companies like Claro and Tigo and Movistar. Now, there are always some companies that'll hook you up with localized internet coverage if you don't have coverage with the big, cheap internet providers. Though the people I talk to who live in and around Lake Atitlan always tell me the coverage is pretty good, with very good smartphone coverage, too. Well, I know what I'd do if I had spotty coverage. Since I don't want to pay a third party that's not one of the big internet companies to come in and charge me an arm and a leg, there's another hack I use whenever I'm out in the boonies and there's not very good coverage. First of all, you have to understand that the big companies like Claro and Tigo, etc., have good solid phone signals. Even the tortilla lady and the shoeshine boys have a data plan on their phone because they use WhatsApp all the time. Now, as far as Lake Atitlan, if you're living in one of the towns that are on the lake, they all have pretty good internet. But there are some tiny little towns of only 200 or 300 people up the mountains that have spotty internet. But the phone service is solid, so why not set up an internet hotspot with your cell phone? And that's what I do anywhere out in the boonies when my internet modem is not solid. I go into the settings on my phone and rig up a hotspot. And what people don't realize is you can keep that hotspot going for minutes, hours, even days, as long as you keep your cell phone data plan paid up. I'm not saying you want to run a business that way through a hotspot, but if it came down to it, you can. So bottom line, if you live in and around the most beautiful lake in the world, Lake Atitlan in Guatemala, then again, people from Lake Como in Italy say it's the second most beautiful lake. Anyway, if you live or happen to be at any one of the towns on the lake, the ones you get to by boat, they've all got the regular, usual suspect plans that are good and cheap. What we're talking about now is when you get up the mountainside into the really small town, so of just a couple hundred people, the thing is, you'll notice all the little guys and gals around you are using their smartphones. They don't have computers, but they have data plans for Facebook and Instacrap, and of course, every Latino's lifeline, WhatsApp. That means any one of them could go into the settings and set up an internet hotspot and borrow that signal on their laptop or pad. But of course, they don't do that because they don't have laptops, iPads, or Galaxy pads. Now, I know that doesn't sound like a very permanent solution, but I'm sure there are lots of other gringos and expats around you can ask, because they're not doing without internet. In fact, many of the mom-and-pop and boutique hotels perched way up in those mountainsides, they have internet dead spots too, but they've got service. Check with them, see what they're using. South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.